This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Peter McGillivray.
Jane Burke.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Peter, we've heard about your time and exploits at Massey Agricultural College, but after that you travelled and then became a lecturer,
well,
I believe.
I wanted to go home and visit my four beers in Scotland, and my good friend J.D.J. Scott, of the same class, wanted to do the same for his four beers in Ireland. But it turned out that both of us wanted to travel through America. Very hard to get into America in the 1950s. But we happily had in our hostel somebody who had been he was over here on a bursary from the States, and he knocked on my door one night and said, "My dad will sponsor you." And his dad was a sheep farmer in eastern Oregon. So we were able to get into the States for 3 months. And this eastern Oregon has a rainfall of about 10 inches a year, if you're lucky, and grows wheat every second year in the same area. It gives us another year to soak up a little bit of moisture. And we spent 3 great months there with Von Borstel was their name. And subsequently, Mrs. Von Borstel came to New Zealand a number of times, and we had a great relationship with them and with the son, who was a student at Massey. So in the States, in those days, new cars in New Zealand were very hard to come by, and we bought a 1942 Plymouth, which in New Zealand would have been quite a smart car. And there it was a throwout. But we organised it so that the back of the front seat could be let down at night. So we slept in that car for about the best part of 6 months. Not very much, a few dollars, yes. But we didn't have many dollars.
So just mean you were sponsored for 3 months, but you could use the car for 6 months.
Well, we at the end of 3 months, and people in New Zealand told you, "We'll make the most use of these 3 months because you'll never get an extension." Well, that was all hogswash. The end of 3 months, we went up to Portland. We went into an office, put our hand on our hearts, and looked up. I think it was a General Eisenhower or somebody up there. And yes, we'll promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and something or other, and got another 3 months. Mm-hmm. So in that 3 months, we tried the car out in the state of Washington. Oh, yeah, it was pretty good. Then we set off on our trips. And we visited then 45 of the then 48 states. So we've seen quite... We started off in California. We started off in Washington. Then California. We go down over the border to Tijuana, Mexico, go inland 400 or 500 miles, go back up to the Canadian border. Go across 100 or so miles, down again to Arizona, Texas. Cross over, get to Chicago. And by then the old car was showing its age. So we said to somebody, "Could we park up here for a long time?" "Yeah, yeah. No, we're merely meant a long time." "Yeah, put her over there." So we parked her up against a Bernardine, we called the car, and we parked it up against this big wall, and it was there for quite some time. But we were close to the Chicago Union Railway Station. And so that was our bathroom. We would go over there down to the basement, and we would shave and carry. And my little friend, he was a short guy, and he related to me many years later. He said, "I've never seen a crowd disperse so quickly. When you brought out your cutthroat razor and started to strop it..." Basically, Chicago just disappeared. But we got various jobs there, including one from United States Gypsum, where they had something called drive-away cars. they would buy a new car for their person representing them in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'd drive the new car to Arizona, bring mm-hmm. the old one back. It was fabulous. You didn't get any money for it. Mm-hmm. And on the first car, we got this from Elmer. I remember it was Elmer in United States Gypsum. Sat in his office with his feet on the table. And we were due to come back on Tuesday. So we report back to Elmer, and he says, "What's this?" He says, "It's Tuesday. You're back on Tuesday." Nobody ever comes back when they tell us they're coming back. So we became mates with Elmer, and we got cars all over. So it gets pretty cold in Chicago. Where do we go this time? We'll go to Florida, I think, this time. Mm. Well, we'll go to Texas. And it was absolutely tremendous. And then we went to work one day. We were delivering mail for the Chicago Union Railway Station on a big top, multiple-story building, and the mail went up there. The bags were opened, and then you went through the letters, and there was you call out Texas, Minnesota, New York, some other place, and you threw the mails there. Pretty old-fashioned, really. Mm. Particularly when I look at the way they sort the mail in Palmerston North these days.
It just goes, it's all done.
So we reported from McGillivray Scott, McGillivray Scott, report to the office. This is when we arrived at work and we thought, they're on to us. Don't say a word, we'll get another day's pay, which we did. We got back and we reported to the office and we got a really reading to there. You shouldn't be working here. And it was getting on for Christmas. And we said to the fellow, "Oh, look, can you let us go to Christmas?" No, he started to quote something about the Fifth Amendment or something. So we said, "Righto, we'll leave." Okay. So we went across the border to they make the cars in. Doesn't matter there. So we crossed the border into Canada with all our belongings. And what'll we do now? Okay, we'll get a car. Is there any cars going back east? Because we had contacts back east in Canada. So we got a car, and I remember it was on Christmas Day, and we covered about three or four states driving across this car. And on one of the... When we got nearer to the next day, we got nearer to Vancouver, the one just south of... We got the American town just over the border.
Seattle.
Seattle. Bellingham or something.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to go over a range of hills, and it was snowing. So we had this car. We had very little money left, and we were getting up. The snow was coming down, and it was silence in the car. Nobody spoke. Finally, we got to the crest of the mountains. Oh, we burst out and chatted to one another. We've made it because we'd been stuck if we couldn't. So we got to the place, and I'm an asthmatic. And by this time, I had a bad bout of asthma. So we had to spend part of our well-earned money to get in to get some shelter that night. And which we did. And then our contact was another person who'd come to Massey, a Canadian, to study at Massey, do a master's course there, and his mother lived in West Vancouver. And we had previously, that had been our base in Vancouver, and we did a lot for her, and she lived by herself with a cat and two ducks. And since we were there, she said, "Oh, I think I'd like to go back over to Montreal or someplace. And you could look after the cat and two ducks." So my little mate, by this time, he had a job as a waiter, where you take things out to a car, big American car, you put the windows down, and you go out with the meal is on a billboard here, and there's another board down here with another meal on it, and you approach the door, you kick the door, and you shoot through before it closes on you and disposes of the meals.
Oh,
and then you put the meal on the car. So he had that job. And I'll stay at home and do the housekeeping for the cat and two ducks. And he would come home at night. And we first of all started discussing the price of the meal so that we were each going to contribute the right amount. And we gave that up because it was so objectionable, eating a potato and then wondering how what cost it was. We wouldn't talk about the cost of it till the end of the week. And she came back, and the cat and two ducks were still alive, and the house was clean and tidy.
I thought you said they ate.
So my mate said that he wants to go to Ireland, off to Ireland. No, I won't go, because I'd heard that you could shear sheep in Canada, and it was good money. So I can shear sheep. So I hung around, and I got a job in Alberta. Or beforehand, while I was waiting for time to go by, I got a job as a powder packer on a raft in the northernmost point of Victoria Island.
A powder packer,
because they were blowing up stumps of trees.
They were
putting a road through the forest.
Oh, gunpowder. Yeah.
So I get up there, and you live on a little raft. The people before us had gone up, and the forest goes right to the water's edge. So they cut the trees here, they fall in there, they lash them together, and that becomes the base for your huts. Mm-hmm. And we were fed like fighting cocks on this camp, and it was my job to pack the powder to a Scandinavian who was up there blowing stumps. So on the first day, it was a 56-pound pack on your back, with this, I suppose it was gunpowder, and take it up to this guy here. He doesn't speak English, but he blows at midday and 5 o'clock. And you set off into the bush wondering, where the hell is this guy? I hope he's not going to blow while I'm here. So I had, on a bad day, I would wear my New Zealand oilskin, a riding coat with a split up the back. Mm-hmm. And they were all intrigued as to, why have you got a raincoat with a split up the back? You couldn't explain that it was a riding coat. And then I didn't have the proper papers to stay in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I was dismissed from that job, went back down to our contact in West Vancouver, and then I got a job on a poultry farm where in the isthmus of the Fraser River, there's lots of little islands, and these people had dragged the boat up onto a little island and started a poultry farm. And my job was to candle eggs from the poultry farm. So candling, you take 4 eggs, 2 in each hand, and you introduce them to an exposed light, and you flip them to see whether there's any cracks in the eggs or blood spots on the egg. So you do that one, and then you do the next one. But while you're doing that, you're turning the egg for in for egg. So you go like this.
Oh, yes. So and you're at the end switching of, hands each time. Yep.
At the end of the day, there was a big pile of bad eggs, the broken eggs. Yeah. However, you got used to it. And you lived in this boat that they'd dragged up on the island. And I wakened one morning, and there was a fellow waving something in my face. He said, "You're an illegal immigrant." He said, "You're not supposed to be here. Off you go." So my time with the egg candling came, thankfully, to an end. And I'd got enough time to go sheep shearing, which was a real godsend.
Did you meet many other New Zealanders doing that? Or was it common for the
there were
young
two,
people?
As we went round the States, we heard of there's two other New Zealanders. Yeah. There's two, and I think it may have been young John Ormond and his mate, because I subsequently found that they were doing the same thing in America. So no, we didn't meet many, but the shearing in Alberta turned out to be a godsend, because it was like gold mining, and at that time people in New Zealand could not get overseas exchange. Mm-hmm. But another classmate, his father was a principal of a College Street school here in Palmerston, and had got leave to go, or study leave to go somewhere. So he was more than happy to take my Canadian dollars, give me the going rate, which was sort of twice what it was from the bank, and it was heavenly, really.
How did you get away with being an illegal immigrant?
You were out on the prairie, and you were working. Hiding. You were working for a very interesting thing, an old truck, and in a shearing shed, you've got the main gear up here, which is a wheel turned on a big steel thing. So that steel thing would be lashed to the side of the truck, And you have a grinder. So the grinder would be in the back of the truck with John and I, and there'd be the two people who ran the shearing gang, they were in the front. And the first one was somebody called Churchwell, and he never had breakfast. He had a couple of gin and tonics for breakfast. And then they were quite good shearers, but you're out in the prairie, and the prairie is not dead flat. The prairie is, it's flattish, but there are gullies and little rivers and that sort of thing. So a very interesting place, the prairie. So you'd get away out there, and the sheep were run in mobs, no fences. They were just Merino-type sheep run who tend to mob together. And so you're out there, go someplace or other, go to the fourth tree in the second creek or something, and you'll meet up the sheep. And he would be looking after the sheep with a little, either drawn by a horse or a tractor, and a little shed with it, which had his cooking place in it and his bed place and a place perhaps for his dog. And he would set up some sort of yards, and then you would shear your sheep out there in the clear day. And the sheep, the wool wasn't put into square bars, put into long bales, and somebody stamped them down. They weren't like our bales. But absolutely fabulous. And then that came to an end.
Yeah. Was there a difference in the style of shearing?
No, same sort of shearing. And one of them was a very good shearer. Hmm. And I think he was a better shearer than I was. So so after that, it came to an end, and I got a job on a cattle research station in Alberta, which was quite good as just a work around the yards. And then, okay, I'm off to Scotland. How do I get from Alberta to Montreal to get the boat, which is a long way away? And, oh yes, I'd heard that there are cattle trains taking cattle which are reared on the range. And by then they're store cattle, so they go over to the west part of Chicago. Was the big place, the Chicago cattle yards, thousands of, but also in Canada. So I get on the train, and it takes, I don't know, 4 or 5 days to get across there, train full of cattle. And we got to somewhere, might have been North Ontario, and we let them out for a drink. So, and yet the train will be leaving at 4 o'clock. So, okay, come 4 o'clock, I'm there, and the train started. And I'm in the cupola at the back, that's where I'm living. But the train's about a mile long. So by the time it gets underway, I'm running to catch up with the train, with this cupola at the back. And the train's faster and faster, and my whole fortune is going to Scotland, and I'm going to miss it. And I had a kit bag from my brother who'd been at the war.
So just a minute. You knew the train was going to go. You weren't on the...
Well, I had to... I must have shown up at the beginning of the train.
Ah, and so you had to run to the end to get into your...
So here's me with this kit bag that my brother had at the war. That was all we had all the way. A kit bag. Mm. Stood as high as this, as round as that.
Yeah, about what? About 1.2 metres.
Yes.
That
had the oilskin in it.
Yeah.
So I've got to get on that train. So I threw the kit bag on and made a lunge and made it.
Yeah.
And got to Scotland. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ah.
So when those cattle came off the train,
they would be
into yards.
Yes, they'd go into yards straight away and water and that. Some of them were in pretty poor shape. I don't know what happened to them. I just, the train finished up and I'm gone.
Yeah.
But then they would be fattened up in yards.
Oh, okay.
And
grain-fed.
Hundreds of thousands of them grain-fed. They were reared on the range with grass and then grain-fed. And in Chicago, there's just millions of cattle fed and then they're butchered over there and where the population is.
So did you have a job on the train, or it was just free transport?
I was getting transport.
Okay, yeah.
And I don't know what I did in there all day, but...
Did they feed you? Did you starve?
No, I'd have had Tucker with me. I'd have probably, I'd have been told about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the train stopped once.
Mm-hmm. So how long was the journey then?
Well, it was some days. Hmm. I can't tell you how much. It wouldn't have been 5 days. It might have been 5 days, but that sort of distance.
Yeah.
I don't know what the distance would be, but it would be 3,000 miles or more.
Oh,
yeah. So did that cost you? You just hitched a ride, or did you?
No, it didn't cost me anything.
No,
you hitched. I was on the cupola at the back.
But they knew you were there.
Oh yeah. Oh yes. Yes. It was all legal. Yes. I don't know whether they had to have somebody there, or how I knew. I don't know how I knew to get that job, or that ride. But it was a great ride.
Oh yes.
Saved a lot of money.
Yeah. And then you went by ship?
By a ship from Montreal to Glasgow.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was as a passenger with a ticket?
I had to pay some money. Pay money there, yes.
And how long did that take?
I suppose it took 4 days or something. Oh, yeah. It was, I can't recall that. It was just, yes, I can't recall.
Okay.
Yes.
And then Scotland.
Scotland, well, that was the start of a whole new chapter.
Yeah.
I've got lots of connections in Scotland. Mm. My father came from the island of Islay, and my mother came from the Kingdom of Fife.
Mm.
So he was a Highlander and she was a Sassenach.
Yes.
So they sort of looked at one another and had both come to New Zealand. My father about 1908, and my mother about 1912. And I just had a fellow, a guest here, who gave, for Christmas, he gave me a book about Islay, about whiskey and the history of Islay, about all the distilleries. Islay is the home of malt whiskies.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. So
what did your father come out here for? Did he come out to go farming?
No. The story I have is that he disagreed with the rules or the way things were done, where you couldn't go and shoot a rabbit. The rabbits belonged to the laird.
Yes,
well, that's one story I have.
Yeah.
But so he's been out here, establishes a family. I'm the last of six. So it's 50 years later, and I go back to Scotland off the cattle train, get to Islay. And there's two aunts who would then be in their late 80s. One of them was half blind, and one other one, and an uncle. And they were on the same farm. And I happened to say, "Oh, look at that, there's a big nail up there. And oh, that's where John hung his fiddle the night he left." The night he left 50 years ago, and nobody's touched that house.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, fabulous. So these two old aunts, one of them, it was her job to go round in the morning to walk round to the burn and get some fresh water for the tea, get some tea water.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle Angus, there were 10 in that family. One of them died, so there's 9 left. And Uncle Angus wasn't a farmer. He was a marine engineer, was his job. But they died off or went away, and so it fell to him to run the farm. And he got help from a nephew who was a rogue. So when the nephew would want a bit of money, he would siphon off a cattle beast and sell it unbeknownst. If we now jump another few years, I turned 90 a couple of weeks since ago.
Yep.
So I've got this one remaining relative that I've told you about. Couldn't come, and because he had an appointment to address the haggis. And that was cancelled. So I get a thing about 10 days before I'll be there. Oh, so that was... Because had he not come, it was up to me to address the haggis in a Scottish accent I can put on. So, of course, it's obviously a put-on one.
Mm-hmm.
He's the real oil.
Yeah.
So he was here. So that was great.
Oh, man.
And his partner, she came too. I hadn't met her before.
Mm-hmm.
And he is he's a second cousin to the cattle thiever. and his father, he's called Neil John, and his father is Neil, and his grandfather was Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the grandfather, they lived on the farm, about 4 miles outside Portnahaven, which is the little fishing village. Mm. So people who live on a farm, don't deal with people in the fishing village. So Neil goes down to the fishing village and comes home with a village girl. Oh, dear, dear, dear. So they get on together, and then they produce a son called Neil. He becomes a Glasgow policeman. And I saw him, by that time I saw him, the last time I saw him, he was in bed with suffering from multiple sclerosis and coming towards the end. But the prior time I saw him as a policeman, we're talking about that, policeman in Glasgow, that was pretty tough. Yes, and they're well known in Glasgow. The story is the razor gangs in Glasgow. And we must have got on to this. And I said, well, how did you know if they had a razor? Well, you'd say, you got a razor? No? Well, you got one now. There's the policeman. here he was in multiple sclerosis. Yes. So this guy, the one who came out here, he makes his life out of music. So he knows all the musicians in Scotland. And he has sort of got a... His job is sort of a voiceover, or he works for radio stations or bands or that sort of thing. Hand-to-mouth sort of existence, but he seems to like it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, often you do that from devotion to the thing rather than for the money.
So how old is he?
Neil John would be... he was a very good friend of another nephew of mine who got killed, probably murdered in Nigeria. So I would think he's 50.
Oh, yeah. So he's quite young.
50. He's got two children. One who works for something called Mary's Meals. That's his daughter, Morven. And Morven is an area of Scotland where a lot of MacGillivrays came from. I don't know if that's why she's called Morven. But she works for voluntary places, particularly Malawi. And something she works for is called Mary's Meals. And she's now got a senior position in Scotland or in the UK to do with Mary's Meals. But they provide 1 million meals a day to people throughout the world, throughout Africa and the UK.
I have had a Mary's
Meals. Oh, yes. Mary's Meal, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how do you enjoyed your time in Scotland? Do you feel a connection to Scotland?
Oh. probably could show you, I don't know if there's any photos there of the birthday party. I'm in my kilt. And we got a girl playing the pipes to usher us in to Warirata, and then the haggis. My daughter made the haggis.
And the whiskey.
Oh, she had a lot. Yes, and I've got an autistic son. He's a big, handsome fellow at 26, 27. Never spoken a word in his life. Just grunts. Yes, he's got dyspraxia. So he was carrying the whiskey, and his father was right behind him in case he dropped the whiskey. I was sitting in church one day, and the guy next to me turned at the end and said, "I'm bipolar." And I didn't really know what bipolar was. But after a while, I thought, now, it'd be good if he could meet up with Jimmy, my grandson.
Yeah.
So that was a happy thing. They're both like this now. They love their food, and they look like it. They're big guys. And they're around at one another's place frequently, you know, a couple of times a week, cooking up food.
So he lives in sheltered accommodation?
Dirk lives in a court. There are about 50 council flats there, mainly for special needs people.
That's good.
Cardrona Court.
Is that off Church Street? In Roslyn.
Yes, up there. So connection with Scotland. Scotland. So I get there and get jobs. Shearing again was one of them. And so I get looking for a get off the boat, wherever it was, and get to Edinburgh. I don't know why. Oh, East of Scotland College of Agriculture is in Edinburgh.
Okay.
I thought I could get a job there. So look in the paper, somewhere to stay. Oh, here's somewhere. A room. Rooms at 26 Jarmer Street. So I go down there with my big hobnail boots on and my oarskin coat and knock on the door. Yeah, we've got a room. Yeah, you're up. You're sharing with the president of the Edinburgh Students Association, a rather refined fellow. And here comes this hopeless fellow, this old shearer. So he turned out to be a really nice guy. Yeah. And the lady that ran the boarding house, she seemed to have family coming and going, and they were very social people. Every now and again they'd put on a party. Yeah, there'll be a party on this Friday night. So I go to one of the parties, and then I find myself at the end of the party. Everybody has gone home except one lady, who's the sister of the proprietor, and she became my wife, with whom I had five children.
So she's a Scotty too.
Oh, Scotland, yes. Yeah. She was a cook. She did the catering at the Callander Golf Course. Callander is a lovely spot. Mm. It's in an area called the Trossachs of Scotland. Very pretty place. So she comes here and. She ended up with started off a little antique shop. She loved that sort of thing. And then we gave that up, and so by now I'm running the hostels at Massey after 14 years. And the hostels are growing. And she says, look, you'll go mad if you stay here, because I like people's names. Mm-hmm. I don't like to deal with people that don't know their name. Mm-hmm. So, and she said, there's a place come up. You've always wanted to be a farmer. There's a farm come up. Make-believe farm, it was 32 and a half acres down at Longburn.
Make-believe.
So I could sell the shop, and so I pulled out of superannuation to get the deposit. There was a lady we knew who grew raspberries in Patama Road, a bit of an old witch of a lady, really. She was pretty hard on her husband, Mrs. Tremaine. don't think we can get. Look, she said, I'll lend you the deposit. Because I was going to pull out of superannuation, but you can't get your hands on the money for 6 months in case you want to change your mind, which I should have done. She lent us the deposit. So we get out to the place. The auction is going to take place on site. So we get out there, a lot of people waiting for the glorious day, lovely old homestead. And who's the opposition but Trevor de Kleene?
No.
Well, Trevor de Kleene was a rogue lawyer here. Nice fellow, Trevor. Nice fellow, Trevor, but he was buying houses. Every week he'd buy two or three places and sell them the next week because the whole thing was going up like that. So we bought it with 110% money owing. Mm-hmm. And I have regretted it now, but the very day I pulled out of superannuation, the next day I should have joined again. I didn't do that for years later. So instead of having 30-odd years of superannuation, I've got a much lesser number. However, I enjoy what I've got.
Yeah.
But that part of the thing.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.